Today's episode of The Scathing Atheist is brought to you by Jerusalem Cigarettes, because an addictive substance that gives cancer to you and all the people closest to you is exactly the kind of thing a loving God would create. And now, The Scathing Atheist.
So, what are we going to teach you about in school? Well, we can teach you about sex, we can teach you how to be a homo, but we're definitely not going to teach you about the Word of God.
Yes, what is it, Tommy?
Mrs. Butterman, how do you be a homo?
Well, bend over, Tommy, and I'll show you.
I'm Daryl Ray, author of The God Virus and Sex and God. And we did, in fact, evolve from sexy monkey men and women.
It's Thursday, it's March 28th, and guess which Sunday after which full moon after which equinox and which hemisphere's coming up? I'm your host, No Illusions, and from profligate New York, New York, this is The Scathing Atheist. On this week's episode, and yes, I said that on purpose, Baptist leaders pledged to civilly disobey gay marriage by not getting gay married even just a little bit. Reasonable Doubt's co-host Justin Schieber will join us to help me master debate. And it turns out the Catholic Church agrees that when you have problems with somebody who has a checkered past with the Nazi Party, you turn to Argentina. But first, the diatribe. I'm often accused of cherry-picking the Bible, and rightly so. They say, Noah, there's some really good stuff in the Bible, but you overlook all of that, and you obsess over the parts with genocide and rape and divinely sanctioned baby murder and people being turned into salt and nut-grabbing prohibitions and scores of children being massacred by bears. Now, I suppose that in my defense, it would be fair to point out that Christians are at least equally guilty of overlooking all the genocide and rape and infanticide and homicidal salinization and ursine bloodbaths and obsessing over the good stuff. In fact, I'd submit that when there's a prophecy of a zombie apocalypse in your book, focusing on any other part is kind of off target. But I have to admit that both atheists and Christians are guilty of cherry-picking the Bible. In a book that long and rambling, I suppose that there's going to be something there to support any view you have. That being said, I think atheists can justify the assertion that the Bible is, overall, an evil, horrible, demonically misguided book. And I think we can make that case even if we have to set aside all the aforementioned butchery and carnage. Hell, let's just look at the most sanitized selection of biblical nuggets we can find. Let's just focus on those Bible stories that Christians tell their kids. How about Jesus died for your sins? Because it's never too early to learn about politically motivated false accusations that lead to brutal capital punishment, right? How about the Exodus? It's never too early to get historical perspectives from a slave narrative that makes Django Unchained look like a fucking documentary. How about the story of Jericho, where the heroic Joshua kills all the men, women, children, and fucking animals, except for a family of turncoats that helped the Israelites in the aforementioned Holocaust against their own neighbors and their own neighbors' pets? And lastly, the most ubiquitous of all the kid-friendly Bible stories, Noah's Ark, the single most horrible story ever imagined by humankind. Here we have a story where God throws a temper tantrum so bad that it ends up killing all but a high school basketball team's worth of people. He was so pissed at the humans that he killed all but two of the Patagonian screaming hairy armadillos, for fuck's sake. We're not just talking about everybody dropping dead one day either. God could have done that if he wanted to, but no. He decided he wanted to flood the whole fucking world. Some of them are going to be smashed to death with logs and debris. Some other people will drown quickly. Others will swim for hours or even float clinging to something for days before eventually succumbing to dehydration or being picked to death by scavengers. You know, consider legendary director Michael Curtiz, who had reenacted this disaster in a 1928 film. He decided that the coolest way to get the shot would be to tell all the extras to just act casual and then dump millions of gallons of water on the set with no warning. Now, sure, he did manage to capture the genuine horror of such a moment. In fact, three of the extras were so inspired by this directorial decision that they improvised their own deaths. Granted, we've largely forgiven Curtiz because Casablanca was so fucking good, but I think we can all agree that flooding the set was the work of a deranged psychopath. Now, this killed three people. I should point out that none of these people were infants either. I'm not trying to excuse what he did, but doesn't that make him less evil than God by at least seven orders of magnitude? More if you count the animals. And don't give me that whole Michael Curtiz was upset with them because of their sin nonsense either. And keep in mind that the story doesn't end with the flood either. It goes all 50 shades of incest a few chapters later when Dad starts with the drinking again. Noah's Ark is a horrible, awful, disgusting, repugnant story, but it's the one that makes the cover on most books of children's biblical stories. Now I ask you, if that's the best you can do for a kid's story, how can you possibly argue that this book is anything but terrible?
They're talking about your Jesus.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Joining me for headlines tonight is my co-conspirator, Heath Enright. Heath, are you ready to co-conspire?
I was born again ready to co-conspire.
All right, so apparently there's a new pope? I just heard about this, and unfortunately the major media outlets haven't really covered the story at all, so I couldn't get any details on the blogs. I guess we'll have to skip that until there's more to cover. I don't know why the media outlets didn't cover this at all, but...
Yeah, I think it's because they communicate generally in smoke signals more than anything else seems to be their MO.
That could be the problem.
It seems a little ridiculous with the whole Vatican chimney and the color of the smoke.
Right. Is that black or is that gray? It looks kind
of
gray.
There's a lot of different shades of gray. And if you're going to do these ridiculous things, you know, go all the way. Why stop where they did? I'd like to see, you know, like a life-size Rube Goldberg device that sends the signal somehow. Like a whole contraption like they got in the Goonies. Somebody has to do the truffle shuffle to get into the Vatican gates and then a whole...
No, you know what? That would never work because the hand that's supposed to push the marble into the tub would always malfunction.
That shit never works at the end
never
of Mousetrap.
Worked.
Never works. Unbelievable.
So, anyway, in our lead story tonight, a recent study shows that the more religious a country is, the more it sucks. Researcher Gregory Paul demonstrated a strong correlation between a nation's religiosity and a host of negative descriptors, including poverty, homicide rates, infant mortality, and teen pregnancy, and found that the more generally dysfunctional a nation is, the more religious it is likely to be.
How many different ways do we need to quantify exactly how bad, damaging, and wrong religions are?
Right. He was just compiling existing data. We already knew this stuff. He was only doing it to counteract the notion that godless societies are somehow doomed to an inevitable decline into sybaritic dystopia.
Well, in Uganda, they have a saying, Hasadiga Iboai, which means, loosely translated, fuck God. Now, this is according to the Book of Mormon. The musical, not the scripture. So unless Matt Stone and Trey Parker were making shit up, there are cultural signs of some God critics out there, too.
Well, I trust them more than I trust that other Book of Mormon. Anyway, we like to be fair on the Scathing Atheist and show both sides. So critics of the study point out that it makes religion look really, really bad, so we should probably just talk about baseball or something. Now, the major outlier in the study, of course, is good old America. Here, of course, 80% of the population still believes in Aesop's fables, despite our relatively high score on the scale of social success. But don't worry, lawmakers in Washington are hard at work lowering that score to match our religiosity. And in other news, the ACLU has recently filed suit against the Puerto Rican Police Department on behalf of Officer Alvin Marrero Mendez, an open atheist who was demoted, ostracized, and publicly belittled by his supervisors for his lack of superstition.
See, this is why I'm glad we live where we do. In the NYPD... That would never happen.
Nope.
He would have been demoted for being Puerto Rican long before they found out he was an atheist.
Yep.
And I just got to make sure I'm selling the sarcasm hard enough on these little racist interjections I make.
Well, as a podcaster that may or may not be Puerto Rican, I forgive you. The suit alleges that during a constitutionally dubious closing prayer after a briefing, Mendez politely excused himself. In response, his commanding officer publicly humiliated him. His service weapon was confiscated. He was taken off the street and given a new job in the department washing cars. Now, in more seditious news, Southern Baptist leader Richard Land has called for civil disobedience over same-sex marriage and the birth control mandate in the Affordable Care Act. He and a group of like-minded Christies explained that these issues are non-negotiable and worth the cost of paying fines and going to jail.
If you don't like gays and condoms, keep having socially irresponsible families of 14 rednecks. Isn't that enough of a civil disobedience already?
Apparently it's not. Apparently the Christians are straight-facedly claiming that equality is a violation of their rights. The first question I had when I read this, though, is how does one exactly civilly disobey gay marriage?
Seems theoretically impossible, doesn't it?
You know, it's not like gay marriage allows gay people to go out and marry straight people, so I don't even know the mechanism by which this would work.
Yeah, if it doesn't even make any sense to try to do what... Yeah, absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, well, to be fair, this is not the first time that a Baptist leader has said something that makes no sense at all to me. And what headline segment would be complete without a facepalm prompting trip to the Bible Belt? This one comes to us from listener Bad Teeth Allen on Twitter. Back in episode 3, we marveled over the stupidity of a proposed law in Mississippi.
I knew it was going to be Mississippi. I knew it was going to be fucking Mississippi. It's always
Oh, come on. That's always like, that's the safest bet,
Unbelievable.
Though, you know?
Setting of my cousin Vinny. Guaranteed some fucking crazy Christian shit happening.
Yes, well, you know, Governor Phil Bryant made sure that their stereo stereotype isn't going anywhere by signing this stupid thing into law. Bryant admits that a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the law is inevitable, but he seems confident that the law will stand up to the legal challenge, and one way or the other, he sees it as a worthwhile expenditure of Mississippi taxpayers' money, saying, I shit you not, quote, if we've got to spend taxpayers' money, I think we would be honored to spend it defending religious freedoms.
Well, it's about damn time the Christians got some freedom to practice in this country. Fuck's sake. If they can't pray in school, we'd have to erect entire separate buildings for the purposes of worship. Entire houses of worship? Would these houses pay property taxes? It would get ridiculous.
In other Bible Belt insanity, Tennessee resident and suspected incubator of demons Andrew Byrd has filed suit against his pastor's wife, and a deacon for injuries sustained in what sounds like a WWE-inspired exorcism. I couldn't find out a lot about this story, but from what I can gather, the lawsuit alleges that Reverend Joel Arwood asked Byrd to attend a meeting at a church because he had a demon that needed casting out. Now, unfortunately, the part of the brain that you, me, and all the listeners have that would trigger a fight-or-flight response if a backwood pastor told us there was a demon in us and we had to show up after hours to have it exorcised.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to have any sympathy from the consumer advocate perspective for this guy.
Caveat emptor and all. But from what I can gather, here's basically what happened. Reverend Arwood's notion of an exorcism is just beating the fuck out of this dude after he shows up. Like, that's basically, he just walks in, and the reverend and the deacon are beating the crap out of him. The wife's screaming, hit him with a chair! Hit him with a chair! I envision, you know, the guy's getting his ass kicked as they're tag-teaming him, throwing him against the ropes, and he's going, like, shouldn't you be throwing holy water on me or something? Anyway, by the end of it, Bird had suffered a broken tooth, bruises on his face, and additional injuries to his back and his legs. And his legs and his back. He's suing for $200,000 in compensatory damages and $3.5 million in punitive damages, but has indicated that he might be willing to settle out of court for 50 cents and some envelopes. And finally tonight, proving that secular people are way better at protesting than religious people, the nonprofit group Planting Peace has enacted my favorite protest of the decade. 31-year-old LGBT activist Aaron Jackson has purchased a house in Topeka, Kansas, and painted it with the Roy G. Biv rainbow of gay pride. No official word on how the neighbors feel about it, but I think we can take a pretty good guess, as the neighbors are the Westboro Baptist Church.
And fucking fantastic.
I love that shit.
If there's a hell, members of the Westboro Baptist Church are being gay raped there. No. And the gay rapist is really clumsy, like with no sense of rhythm. A gay rapist that's good at sex would be way too pleasant for them.
No, but yeah, that's the thing, because when somebody's as obsessed with gayness as Fred Phelps is, he's gay. He doesn't get to get ass raped in the afterlife. He would love that shit.
No, I would definitely be down to, like, gay hate fuck Fred Phelps. Like, consensually. If I was able to talk him into a scenario like that, I'm not gay, but, like, in a totally, like, non-sexual way. Like, just based on the hate.
Just really dry and, yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah. Like, power top. I would go all the way. Balls deep. Fred Phelps. Take it to the bank.
Yeah, and what I love about this is that they basically bought this just to antagonize that motherfucker.
Love it.
They had no trouble at all finding some local volunteers to help them paint it, because I don't think the people in Topeka like to be associated with that jackass all that much.
If there's a group that's just viscerally offended by rainbows, they deserve to be regularly offended. That's absurd. Those are the colors of the visible spectrum. What the fuck's the matter with you? It's part of the universe.
All right, so ending on that positive note, Heath, thanks for joining me.
Glad to be here.
And when we come back, Justin Schieber will join us for a public debate on the merit of public debate. It's time for the Atheist Calendar portion of the show. I haven't had to dedicate a whole segment to a single weekend before, but it looks like if you missed the American Atheist Convention in Austin, there's a really good chance that there's an awesome secular conference much closer to you on the weekend of April 6th. We'll start in the Northeast with Nexus, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. They've really outdone themselves this year with a phenomenal slate of speakers, including Leonard Mlodinow, Simon Singh, Michael Shermer, Mariette DiChristina, Massimo Pigliucci, and at least a dozen others worth mentioning. There's a lot to look forward to, but I'm most excited about a podcasting workshop I'll be attending with Dr. Stephen Novella and Dr. of Funk George Robb. You can expect to see a marked improvement in the quality of this podcast after that weekend, and if you don't, let me know so I can ask for my money back. Now, if you're in the North but not in the East, fret not, as the Northwest Freethought Conference is taking place over the same weekend. Friend of the show, Hemant Mehta, will be the keynote speaker there, but he'll be sharing the stage with some other notable names like Daryl Ray, Valerie Tirico, and more. It'll be taking place at Portland State University and includes three action-packed days of events and speakers. If you're in the North but kind of in the middle, I've still got something for you. In Minneapolis, the Skeptech Conference will be bringing in Greta Christina, Jesse Galef, the seemingly omnipresent Hemant Mehta, and the Dr. Octopus of Atheism himself, P.Z. Myers. There are plenty more great speakers, all themed around skepticism and technology. Should be a lot of fun. Also, keep in mind that April 6th and 7th are the Just Pray No to Drugs weekend, where a bunch of superstitious yahoos will call upon the power of their invisible space rapist to end all drug use. So if you're concerned about the ongoing meth epidemic, don't worry, the Christians have it under control. And finally, of course, this weekend also marks the celebration of Easter, when Christians believe that the baby Jesus rides his submammalian egg-laying lagomorph down from heaven to give cavities to all the boys and girls. That'll do it for the calendar this week, but as always, if you're involved with an atheist, secular, or skeptical event that's in need of some free publicity, let me know. You'll find all the contact info along with links to all the events discussed on this program at scathingatheist.com. Co-host of Reasonable Doubt's Justin Schieber sat down with me the other day for a discussion on the merits and techniques of debating theists. Unfortunately, due to a technical error on my end called forgetting to push the fucking record button, I wasn't able to capture the audio. As luck would have it, though, Justin was recording the interview from his end as well. Now, there was a step down in audio quality, but the information was preserved. I apologize in advance. I did everything that I could to clean up the audio here, but it's still well below the standard that you've come to expect from us. That being said, I believe the quality of the information more than makes up for the crappiness of the audio, so here it is. Enjoy, and I promise never to make you sit through audio this crappy again. All right, I'm here with Justin Schieber, co-host of Reasonable Doubts, my skeptical guide to religion. Justin, welcome to The Scathing Atheist.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you bet. I'd like to start with a bit of flattery here. Reasonable Doubts is my favorite podcast on the subject of religion, and I'm including my own podcast when I say that, so I want to thank you guys for all the hard work you do. You put on a phenomenal show.
Ah, well, thank you very much for the kind words. I've heard good things about your show as well.
Well, I appreciate that. Now, as much as I love your show, ham-fisted adulation is only part of the reason I invited you on. It would seem that over the last couple of months, you've become something of the debater-in-chief over there at Reasonable Doubts. You debated John Alistair on the Amalekite genocide, John Barron on the morality of abortion, and most recently Jared Orme on the existence of God. So my question for you, sir, is why are you so damn disagreeable?
Well, that Amalekite debate, that would have been funny if it wasn't so damn disturbing, right?
I've got to tell you, I don't know how you managed to get through it without popping the guy in the nose, specifically when he decides that the fault for the death of the children is on the parents who failed to get them out of town before the... Mm-hmm. Genocide.
Absolutely priceless. Why am I so disagreeable? I don't know. I guess I just hold positions that people feel passionately about on both sides, and so I use that for my own intellectual exercise, I suppose.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you bring to the stage? What are your credentials?
Oh, I actually don't have any. I'm not formally trained on any of this stuff. This is just a personal hobby of mine. Ever since I went through my deconversion, I suddenly became fascinated with a whole array of subjects. And that's the good thing about these issues, is they're tied so intrinsically to so many fascinating fields of inquiry. Philosophy and science and just, I mean, those two pillars and everything that's connected to them. And all the relevant questions that are attached to, questions like, what's the best way to go about forming your view of the world? You know, all those questions, they're so fascinating to me. And because of that, that's driven my bookshelf choices for the past several years. And so that's mainly my credentials are self-imposed.
Excellent. Well, I'm actually happy to hear that. It makes me feel a little more comfortable that maybe someday I could do the same. Now, this seems like probably the most fundamental question, but also kind of a tricky one. How do you define victory in a debate?
Oh, that's a very good question. I was actually taking some notes on the topic we were going to be discussing today, and I that was one of my main things. You know, what do we mean when we talk about winning a public debate? Presumably, we mean public debates in some way, can they be beneficial for the atheist movement? And of course, that's going to depend on what the aim is for the atheist movement, right? Are we trying to convert people to our side? Or are we merely concerned with teaching people how to think rather than what to think? You know, if we manage to make a theist think more analytically, but yet they use that new analytic thinking to defend their theism with a kind of Swinburnian sophistication, should we consider that a win? I don't know if I have an easy answer to that question. My gut tells me that it's a partial win, but it's not all the way.
All right, so
Now, if you flip that question on its head, obviously there has to be some kind of risk debated or in these public debates as well. What do you stand to lose?
Oh, I don't know. I think that the main problem with debates like these is that people go into them, especially if they're very ideological debates, people go into them thinking their opponent, underestimating their opponent, right? So they don't prepare. They don't try to understand their opponent, where they're coming from, and they don't foresee objections to their... And I think that that's a very big problem. So I don't think that people should be debating unless they're really willing to put the homework in and do the work and understand their opponent, do so with a respectful and professional tone, because that alone is going to turn off your audience. If you make all the good arguments, but you're a total dick, you're not going to be persuasive to your audience. And as we know, persuasion isn't just about logical arguments. If we're out there trying to get people to our side, logical arguments aren't sufficient.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm fond of saying they didn't logic their way in, you're not going to logic them out.
Exactly.
And for that reason, now I'm a big fan of listening to your debates. I love listening to Dawkins and Hitchens throwing down. But I'm like exactly what you're saying. I'm the ideologue. I know I'm just going to hear my opinions confirmed to me. Mm. So there's a lot of pushback, I think, in the atheist community as to whether we should even be doing these debates. Some people even say that we elevate the position of the people that we debate. You know, obviously you're not endorsing it if you're debating it, but you're at least endorsing it as debate worthy. How do you respond to that criticism?
I think that refusing to debate people simply because it's going to have the appearance of elevating your opponent's position is just an eloquent begging the question, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, can I give you an example?
Sure.
Say you've got a preeminent geologist that goes up on a stage and debates a flat Earth proponent.
Mm-hmm.
Just the fact that his name is on the handbill with this flat Earth proponent might bring more people to say, okay, this is something that this preeminent geologist felt was worth his time to debate.
Right. So, I mean, I think there are good reasons to not debate, for instance, creationists, you know, young Earth creationists. But I don't think it's this. You know what I mean? So I think that something like, clearly. Creationist type thinking is a big problem, right? And it needs to be addressed. And so obviously we're just talking about how we do that. I think that one of the best reasons against publicly debating creationists is because of the topic, right? So evolution is a complicated subject. It's a widely misunderstood subject. And answering these kinds of creationist arguments, especially the more obscure and specific ones, require laying massive amounts of groundwork and correcting huge misunderstandings before even getting to the particulars of their argument. So this just isn't really possible given the time limits of a public debate. And so I think it's just going to be a disaster, generally speaking, if you have, you know, some prominent geologist and then some young earther, it's just going to be a disaster because the young earther is just going to appeal to those arguments that appeal to their intuitions. And the people on his side and the people on the fence, if they're not used to thinking critically about things, they're going to find the more intuitive arguments more persuasive.
Now, I've got something of a Miss America question for you here as well.
Oh, boy.
Who would you most like to debate? What would be the topic? And who would be the audience?
Oh, God. Well, shoot, that's for different reasons. William Lane Craig would be my top. I would love a chance to debate that guy.
Wow, you're going straight for the title fight. I love it.
Because I think that people that go against him are generally just to a laughingly terrible degree unprepared. I wouldn't say that of all the people that he's debated, but I think the vast majority of them have been woefully unprepared.
I think it's exactly what you're saying, that they underestimate him in just because of the asinine nature of some of these arguments.
Exactly, yeah. Secondly, Frank Turek, I would love to destroy him on stage in front of many, many, many people.
I would love to see that. I'll do anything I can to make it happen. Okay, so now I've never done anything like what you do. I've never been in the structured debate format, but I kick some ass on Twitter. So no, it's only tangentially related, but do you think that there's any benefit to those arguments, those social media arguments many of us find ourselves locked into?
I mean, yeah, I suppose I'm the one who runs the Doubtcast Twitter at Doubtcast. So I engage in a lot of those as well, a bit of a guilty pleasure. As to how productive they are, I mean, they're useful for, I don't know, kind of correcting those really stupid, like, bumper sticker slogans that you hear on both sides, you know? I mean, other than, I mean, if... I've gotten into a few exchanges where it's led to other other mediums, right, where we can hash these issues out in a more productive way.
But more than 140 characters, I guess.
Exactly. And that's, of course, the main problem with Twitter is that there's the limit of the medium. But yeah, I mean, I think it's useful. I think it's very useful, but, you know, you just got to keep the limits in mind.
Right. All right. So what advice would you give to the casual social religious debater?
Well, I guess it would be different depending on what side they're on.
Assuming they're on the free thinking side.
There. Okay. I would say you're going to be a lot more persuasive if you actually read the Bible, if you actually spend the time to understand the theist, do the hard work. And I promise, if you haven't done it, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, this literature, I mean, say what you want about it, there's some really horrible shit in it, right? But there's also some really great things about it. It's largely beautiful literature, and it should be respected for that. The fact that people still buy into this stuff is unfortunate, but understanding it is I think, a prerequisite to really being persuasive with anybody, with any real hope.
Excellent. Wrap up with one quick question. And this is a question I'm sure you get a lot of, and no, it's not a Justin Bieber joke. Is Luke Galen a vampire?
Huh.
There's no picture of him on the Free Thoughts blog. He didn't come with you guys to the 100th anniversary. He sparkles in the daylight. What's up with this guy?
I don't know. Luke's an interesting guy. But Luke is the very obscure one. He is in a sense a vampire.
Hey, oh yeah, I was gonna say. But you hang out with him because he's in that coffin during the day most of the time. Okay. Well, and finally, if my listeners can't get enough of your dulcet tones, where can they find more of you?
If they go to doubtcast.org, that will link to our blog at Free Thought Blogs, and we. As I mentioned earlier, we're on Twitter at Doubtcast, and we also have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/doubtcast, I think is what that would be.
Excellent. Well, we'll link to it all, of course, on the show notes for this episode. Again, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
The interview ran a little long, so I'll have to close out the show pretty quickly, but we have a really big announcement before we cue the music. Since we started doing this thing, the most prevalent theme in our feedback has been more please, so I'm happy to announce that we're doubling our workload and moving to a weekly schedule, and from now on, I'm dedicating all the odd-numbered episodes to all the awesome people who sent encouraging emails and tweets, left complimentary comments on the blog, gave us positive reviews on iTunes, and otherwise helped us get this whole thing started. Thanks for all your support, and we'll be working really hard to keep earning it every week. We'll be back in 168 hours for our We're Weekly Now edition with co-host of an American Atheist podcast, Tom Beasley, for a pre-autopsy of religion. But if you can't wait that long, be sure to follow us on Twitter at Noah_Lusions and check out our erratically published blogs. Before we close it out, I want to thank author and indispensable activist Daryl Ray for providing this week's Farnsworth quote, or paraphrase. I also want to thank Lucinda for teaching me how to be a homo, Justin Schieber for being the world's most patient interviewee, and of course my partner in crime, Heath Enright, for all his numerous contributions to the show. Also want to thank Cecil and Tom over at Cognitive Dissonance for an awesome shout-out. Those guys are awesome podcasters, so they, of course, make an awesome podcast. If you like our show, please help us spread the word by leaving a positive review on iTunes or adding us to your favorites on Stitcher. And if you don't have the Stitcher app yet, get on that shit or the kids on the street will think you're a square. If you have questions, comments, or death threats, you'll find all the contact information along with links to all the events and headlines discussed on this program at scathingatheist.com. All the music used in the program was written and performed by yours truly, and yes, I did have my permission. ¶¶ joining me for headlights. No.
For headlights?
Joining me for headlights.
This guy keeps looking at me.